what makes somebody a good negotiator? What does the smarter look like? So if all of this is about two lines of code, like so much of your book revolves around, once you understand how people are wired, once you understand what their religion is, once you understand their two lines of code, we become controllable isn't the right word, but we become movable.
Influenceable, if yeah. that's a word.
So how do we begin to suss that out? So when you're sitting across the table, and I know that a lot of this deploys against business negotiations, but I want to keep it when lives are on the line. So ultra high stakes, literal life and death. What are you asking? What are you looking for? How much of, like, the fact that you guys have these teams and everybody's broken up, okay, you're looking for positive statements, you're looking for negative. Walk us through that. What's the setup? And then how are we going to tease out this information?
Well, yeah, the setup is, yeah, we're going to pull together a team because there's so much in what's said and the way it's said, even more in the way it's said, that there's more information coming off a person. Even if you can't see them, there's more information that you can keep up with if you're not trying to respond. And then, you know, you formulate a statement in your mind, and the amount of time that you're formulating a statement, you're not listening. So there's just more data there than one person can handle. So we built a team concept, and we had different people listen for different things. And the more we thought about it, like, how long did the conversation go? How much profanity, which is, you know, emotional adjectives. How many emotional adjectives were in there? Negative emotional adjectives. As the conversations get longer and there's fewer negative emotional adjectives, you're making progress. It's never a straight line, so it's going to go and come. So, you know, what's our pulse? What's our frequency? And then when people really start listening for the nuances, and you get five people together. I mean, if you want to listen for everything, you probably need at least five people keeping track of everything. And then the patterns start to emerge really fast. Or like in a Tractor Man siege in D.C. and
Tractor Man?
Yeah, Dwight Watson drove a tractor to the middle of Washington, D.C., in 2003, just before the beginning of the first Iraq war. And his family had been crushed by the tobacco industry settlement. They were no longer able to farm and sell enough tobacco. You know, I don't know, but the tobacco industry settlement ended up crushing his family business. He tried to protest in D.C. a couple of times, got legal permits to protest. Nobody cared. You know, save the tobacco farmer. That ain't exactly a hashtag that's real popular.
Yeah.
And it's not their fault that that's how they grew up making a living, which was completely legal, acceptable, and nothing wrong. And then the world suddenly decides it's a bad thing. So he protests a couple years in a row. Nobody cares. So he rolls back into D.C. now with his tractor and his trailer and his 4x4 and claims he's got bombs. Which gets everybody's attention.
Has a way of doing it.
Yeah, you'll get somebody's attention. The work in a case, Park Police negotiators, we're backing them up, we're coaching them, we're doing all the analysis for them. You know, we're the team that we put up around them because we work a good team. And we get to the point where he's found a face-saving way to surrender. You know, he said, I was in the 82nd Airborne, parachutes behind enemy lines, and you're there for 72 hours with no backup, you can withdraw. So basically, he's agreed to come out after 72 hours. Now, the problem is, he's a volatile dude, and since we don't know for sure whether or not he's got explosives, in a fit of rage, if he goes the wrong direction, the sniper's got a green light on him. And we're thinking, like, all right, we got to keep this guy from getting himself killed. Because when you're in a rage, you're going to do something stupid, and there's a very specific protocol where we suspect the explosives might be, and if he makes a move for the explosives, we cannot wait and find out if they're there. And so we're thinking, like, we got to get this guy out of here in less than 72 hours because that's just too much for stable behavior. We cannot expect him to stay cool for 72 hours. So there's a disagreement within in the negotiation cell as to when he said he's going to come out. And I look at the negotiators and I go, when's Dwight coming out? And they go like, yeah, he's coming out tomorrow. And I said, I don't think he is. I think we're still 36 hours away. You know, we're not 8 hours away. Well, we'll call him and ask him. And I'm like, hold it. Before we call him, in the event he's not coming out tomorrow morning, what are we going to say to get him to change his mind? Now, we've heard all this military stuff, all this hyper-masculine stuff. And buried in the military jargon and the hyper-masculine stuff, there are hints of his religion, which is Christianity. Just hints of it. Just hints. And Winnie Miller, a female negotiator on my team, sitting in the back of the room. And what do we say? And Winnie goes, tell him tomorrow's the dawn of the third day. Because, you know, in the Christian religion, Jesus crucified on Friday, he gets up on Sunday. That's 48 hours. Mm. That ain't 3 days. That's not 72. It's 1 day to Saturday. It's 2 days to Sunday. So we're thinking about this. And we're like, yeah, okay. Dawn of the third day. So we call him back on the phone. They go, Dwight, when are you coming out? You coming out tomorrow, right? And he goes, no, I'm not coming out tomorrow. And then the negotiator brilliantly, because delivery is as important as awards. She brilliantly says, Dwight, tomorrow's the dawn of the third day. There's this long silence on the other end of the line. He goes, I'll come out tomorrow. Now, she saved his life. Because I promise you, the 24 more hours, he'd have cracked and he'd have made some move where the sniper would have taken him out. And we did not want that to happen. By this point in time, we're talking to this, and this poor schmuck has just been crushed. He's tried to get the world's attention. We don't think he's got bombs, but we don't know he doesn't have bombs, and we can't take that chance. We got to get him out of there before he gets himself killed. And so that was kind of, you know, here's a guy doing something that looked really bad, but there was still, possibly to your point, what's inside somebody? You know, what are those kernels, those grains that are still in there that maybe we can uncover, that maybe we can reach in and reach? And we got him out. He came out, that nobody got hurt.
Okay, so that was a case of literally knowing their religion.
How are you going to get paid if you kill people? How are we gonna collaborate? You know, how much are you losing by getting rid of hostages when you could have gotten paid for them? Because somebody's gonna scare up the money for the hostage.
Right.
Somebody's going to. A hostage negotiator's real job internationally is to make sure that if somebody scares up that money, that there's enough of a trail left that you can hunt them down afterwards. It's exactly why you give a bank teller bait money. You don't want the bank teller to get shot over money. Now, you also don't want the bank robber to leave the bank with the entire contents of the vault. You give them enough money so the bank teller doesn't get shot, the bad guy leaves, and you chase them down afterwards. That's the way to save lives and put the bad guys out of business. So you want to get them focused back on the money again. And then if they kill more hostages, it's their loss. And that's when they start to think like, all right, well, maybe we made our point. You know, let them feel that way. Who cares how they feel as long as you get what you want? And that's the idea to try to re-engineer the outcome.
That's really interesting. That is that an easy position to take? Because it definitely makes them feel like we're a game, this is a game, or they're a chip, versus like you almost have to divorce yourself from their humanity, and meaning the hostages.
Right.
I can't even think about them as people right now because that may stop me from actually getting them back. Is that, do you approach it that way? Or are you trying to hold front and center, this is somebody's mom, daughter, whatever, and keep that front of mind? Like, how do you, what's the best tactic?
Well, you learn the success tactic again. And I learned it from Gary. The process is you lower their value as a bargaining chip. You increase their value as a human being to the bad guys. So that decreases the chances not only the bad guys will kill them, but also you impact how they're treated in the meantime.
That's incredibly shrewd. So how do we lower their value as a bargaining chip? And then how do we increase their value as a human without the person feeling like they're being manipulated? That's always the fine line.
Right, right. Well, it's one of the reasons for potentially for a proof of life question. Not necessarily that you're getting proof of life, but you're making them thinking about it as a human being. Mm. Like, all right, at this point in time, we got no hostage still alive. What's, Martin Burnham's favorite thing to do with his kids first thing in the morning? And by asking that question, you force a thought pattern into the bad guys. Because they were kids at one point in time. You know, terrorists, really bad guys. It's not that they're completely lacking in emotion. They're completely lacking in certain emotions, which means they've had some emotional experiences that you want to see which ones are there that they resonate positively with. You know, one of the crazy things that I learned a long time after the fact is terrorists got moms. I mean, you'd be shocked at the emotional vulnerability across the board to the power of a well-crafted message from a mom.
Really?
I mean, and if, like the first, we found this out, and again, my boss, Gary Nestner, he had a great feel for this. We're in the midst of the first case, Jeff Schilling case, which a bad guy, nobody died, hostage walks away because the bad guys get so disorganized and disheartened. And 2 months after the case, the serial killer terrorist on the other side calls the negotiator that I coached to congratulate him on how effective he was. Not in a rage, but to literally say, you know, you're really good at what you do.
Wow.
They should promote you. So in the midst of that one, bad guys are threatening that they're torturing the American. Not they're going to kill him, but they're torturing him. And the State Department is like, you know, we got to get this torture threat off the table. And I remember thinking, like, you're not really bent out of shape unless you're being made to look bad here. Because having an American tortured overseas makes you look bad. And that's what you're concerned about. I'm like, all right, so we'll see what we can do. And I talked to my boss, Gary, and I'm like, all right, so how do we go from release him to be nice to him? This is absurd. And Gay says to me, he says, tell him that his mom is worried about him. And I can remember literally in that moment, like I held the phone away from my head and I remember looking at the phone and I thought to myself, that is the dumbest effing thing I have ever heard in my life. And I kind of rolled my eyes and I used to ignore so much of what Gary told me anyway. You know, he was good. He gave me a lot of rope. And so I go, okay. We'll see if we can work that into the conversation because I want to make him feel like I was paying attention to him. So we coach up the negotiator the next day and, you know, we got the negotiation operations center set up and we got sheets of paper with dialogue and we're going to be there with him the whole time. You can hear tone of voice. When you get the cadence, you got a pretty good idea what's being said just based on tone. And we tell him, he says, you know, you got to work this mom thing into the conversation. And he looks at us like, you're kidding, right? I'm like, just find a way to work it in. So he's on the phone with a bad guy, and we're all but getting him to come right out that they're not torturing him, because they're not. I mean, there's no need to, but it makes them look good to claim they are. And Benji says to the bad guy, says, you know, his mom's worried about him. And the sociopathic terrorist on the other end of the phone literally says, his mom knows about this? You tell her he's okay.
Whoa.
And we're like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And, you know, we're on the other side of the clock in Manila. You know, we're 12 hours on the other side of the clock. So it's the middle of the afternoon for me. It's 1:30 in the morning for Gary. Mm. And I'm like, I got to get this out of the way. I mean, I have to get this out of the way. So I immediately call Gary and I wake him up in the middle of the night. You know, he always took the calls. 1:30 in the morning, phone rings, and I hear me, hello. And I go, you always effing have to be right. And he's like, what do you mean? And I go, I don't know how you know that this guy was going to resonate with the mom stuff, but it worked perfectly.
How did he know? Did he say?
You know, great gut instinct. But once we started looking for it, then it would show up in case after case. And which is really hard, you know, once I was looking for that dynamic, every terrorist got a mom. And if you had to bet, it's a good bet that they're bonded to their mom. Like physically, they were born, they had to have a mom. Mom was probably nurturing, all the different stuff that bent them out of shape and turned them into the twisted human being that they became. Probably didn't have anything to do with mom. So they still got deep inside, you know, first year of their life, they were nurtured by mom. Mom did everything she possibly could. Even terrorists got moms. And I saw this show up a couple times later on, and I started realizing it was probably, you took me to Vegas, which I live there now, and you said, place a bet. Is this guy going to resonate emotionally with the mom? And I'd say, based on our data, we got an 85 to 90% chance that the mom is a button we can punch. And so then in subsequent cases, knowing this, I bring it up with ambassadors or you know, FBI headquarters or the White House. And they'd all react the exact same way that I did. That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. That ain't, you know, they're inhuman. That ain't ever going to work. And I saw evidence of it in 2012 when Son of Al-Qaeda, the group in Iraq that was chopping people's heads in 2014 timeframe. Their name will come to me after the fact. But there was one case there where the mom card got played really strongly, and the head of the group responded. And I remember thinking, like, I've been telling, you know, I know this sounds crazy, but we see it over and over and over again. So there's a common humanity thread to every human being, regardless of circumstances.
Remember, you don't get in life what's fair, you get what you negotiate. If you want to become a better negotiator, click the link in the description below.
That's why they're doing them carjackings. Boy gets kidnapped, father's not an American citizen, he knows his son is. He goes to the U.S. Embassy, says, my son's an American citizen. He's been kidnapped. You're supposed to help me. They say the FBI is going to be there to help you. Now, I don't know what went through his mind when he was told that the FBI was going to be there to help him. I can imagine it was probably something equivalent of 15 minutes later, he's going to hear on the front door, and these guys will be there. They might even have FBI hats on. So you know they're FBI agents. But instead, about 15 minutes later, he gets a call from some guy in Washington, D.C. named Chris Voss. And he literally says to me on the phone, you're in Washington, D.C. How are you going to help me? How much time do I have before this father hangs up the phone? You're me. What do you say? Seriously, what would you say? Gonna get your son back. Logic. Lay some reality out to him. Tell me what happened. Interesting. Who thinks tell me what happened is an open-ended question? It's a command. And it's a statement. Tell me what happened. When you run into people in your businesses, what's the first thing they say to themselves, especially if they're under stress? Is it any different than what this father said to me? Do you have any less time? And what you need to establish, you know how much time you have? Does anybody know? How much time do you have before they either literally or figuratively hang up on you? Before you're losing the game? How much time do you have? 7. You got 7 seconds. Tick, tick, tick. Tell me what happened. How much time does that take? Person under stress. Can they go, okay, I'm really glad you asked. You know, now that you think about it, let me go back through this. Think about it one step at a time. How did I get in? It all started when I was 7 years old. I can't answer that question. I mean, who can under stress? 7 seconds. And what do you have to establish? What you have to establish is the same thing I had to establish. What is it? Trust. Absolutely. Trust and competence. Exactly right. You get 2 things, trust and competence. Not confidence, competence. And you get 7 seconds. What do you say? Trust me, I'm confident. If that worked, would you need videos to market your practice? Probably not. Trust me, I'm from the FBI and I'm here to help you. How do I know how to do this? Because I did it wrong in the past. The first time I was in the Philippines on a case, and I'm going to touch on it before we get done here this morning. They walked me into a room that the heads of the government are all there from the Philippines. I'm there at the express personal invitation of the American ambassador. The head of the FBI in Manila has gone to the ambassador and given him my name and said, we need this guy, and we have to officially invite him to come and help, and we need to walk him into this room where everybody except the president of the Philippines is going to be. The secretary of defense is going to be there. The head of the police is going to be there. Police in the Philippines is the national police force, so the head of the police is the equivalent of a cabinet-level position. And at the time, the president's 2 closest personal advisors were the secretary of defense and the head of the police. The only reason the president of the Philippines wasn't in the room is because then his personal confidential advisor was. And in sum and substance, they said to me, how are you going to help us? And I took this as the opportunity to lay out my resume. FBI agent, so many years. Joint Terrorist Task Force, New York City. Winner of the Attorney General's Award. Winner of the FBI Agents Association Award for Distinguished and Exemplary Service. Not only teach from the book at Quantico now, I wrote the book we teach from. Not only trained by the FBI, but trained by Scotland Yard as well. Laid out my extensive credentials, and I can tell you they were suitably unimpressed. They may as well have yawned in my face. Why is that? You guys know why. If your credentials showed that you knew what you were doing, you would never hire the wrong person in your firm, and you would never fail, would you? Your credentials correlate loosely with whether or not you know what you're doing. Loosely. What I say to this father? Simple. Here's what I said. All right, Haitian kidnappers are not killing each kidnap victims these days. I realize that's really stupid because they kill each other at the drop of a hat, but they're not killing kidnap victims. Now, today is Thursday, and Haitian kidnappers love to party on Saturday night. If you do say the things I want you to say, when I want you to say them, we're going to have your son out late Friday or early Saturday morning. He said, tell me what you want me to do. And we had his son out Saturday morning. So let's break down a little bit of what I did do, and also, more importantly, what I didn't do. By the way, through the course of the kidnapping, the father never asked me how many kidnappings I'd worked. He never asked me how long I'd been an FBI agent. He never asked me how long I'd been a hostage negotiator. He never asked me if I spoke French or Creole, the languages. He never asked me how many times I'd been to Haiti. You guys may have asked yourself, this guy's a lead international kidnapping negotiator. He's negotiated all over the world. How many languages does this guy speak? By now, the answer to that is abundantly clear, barely one. How many times I've been to Haiti? You guys know how many times I've been to Haiti? I've never been to Haiti. Never asked me that. None of those typical competence indicators ever came up. As soon as I told him what he was looking at, here's what you're looking at. And then I offered him the slightest bit of insight into how to navigate that. And he said, tell me what you want me to do. I will also ask you to compare how long it took me to say that with how long it took me to lay out my resume, which was shorter. Most communication hacks, most ways to shortcut the actual process and make it last less time seem really indirect and save time. It seems like you're going in another direction and it ends up shortcutting the process significantly.
What business are you in? I think you guys are in the trust business. What business was a hostage negotiator in? I was in the trust business. But take the word trust out and drop in the word predictability. And then things begin to change. Because as soon as you begin to make things more predictable and understandable, now you begin to help them in huge ways. Your clients, buyers and sellers, match almost exactly the psychological profile and reactions of the family members of a kidnapped hostage. Somebody's family member gets kidnapped, their child gets kidnapped, and their hopes and dreams for the future have been taken hostage, have been hijacked. When your home is for sale, or you're trying to buy a home, these are hopes and dreams for the future. Very same profile. You can Google the most stressful events in people's lives, and buying or selling a home, especially selling a home, is very high on that hit parade. And the other interesting thing about this is the very same as a kidnapping, is when a kidnapping starts, the family doesn't know when it's going to be over. Even though I know, I can guess within, if I know the profile of the case and I know the country that it's in, I can guess within either a week or a month as to how long it's going to take. I know, but they don't know. They haven't been through this before. One of the definitions of traumatic stress is that it's unrelenting. They don't know when it'll be over. Your clients, your buyers and sellers, they don't know when this is going to go away. They don't know when it's going to be over, and that is overwhelming for people. That's why they call it traumatic stress. In the kidnapping business, we found out that the families of kidnapped victims suffered traumatic stress at the same rates as the victims because they didn't know when it was going to be over.
This video is about labels, the ultimate negotiation tool. Sometimes we think of it as the ultimate MacGyver tool. What makes it a MacGyver tool? Well, a MacGyver tool is really simple and incredibly effective, ridiculously effective. To do your labels right, you gotta keep them simple. Stick to the format. It seems like, it sounds like, it looks like. You seem, you sound, you look. We have a great negotiator that loves to say it feels like. Stick to that simple format. We're intentionally leaving the word I out. I is a thought interrupter, a pattern interrupter. When you use the word I, it draws attention to yourself. It interrupts the other side's thinking. And you're using labels to gather information. We know from negotiation that you add this to gather information. The crazy thing is, asking questions is not always the best way to gather information. Labels work well more of the time than asking questions do. Labels trigger stream of consciousness reactions. You might say to somebody, what are you thinking about this? You might label them instead and say, seems like you're giving this a lot of thought. Or it seems like you're thinking about something here. Or it seems like you saw some things you like. Either one of those is going to trigger a much more unvarnished flow of thoughts from the other side. one of the people who's really learned this stuff and is doing a great job of applying this in a real estate area calls it unlocking the floodgates of truth talk. Happens to be a woman that's applying this and seeing the insights, and not the least bit surprising because women have a tendency to pick this stuff up faster than men do. That doesn't mean men can't be great at it also, just that for whatever reason, women seem to get a head start on understanding this and applying it really quickly. This is emotional intelligence-based negotiation. One of the crazy things about this is that when Brandon and I brought these hostage negotiation techniques out of hostage negotiation into the business world, we didn't think labels were that big of a deal. I can tell you now that we both use them so much that we can work our way entirely through a negotiation only using labels. When you get good at them, you respect their simplicity, and you apply them, you can use them all over the place. One of the main things that makes labels incredibly versatile is the fact that all three types like them a lot. We've done a lot of polling. We've got a lot of reason to believe that the world pretty much breaks up into three types: assertives, analysts, and accommodators, across the board, regardless of gender or ethnicity. We probably polled at least 2,000 people in this regard. We got a fair amount of data. And in polling all these people, and in different classes we've taught, we frequently run exercises where we ask them, of the 9 negotiation skills, which skills would you most prefer your counterpart use with you in order to make a great deal with you? All three types pick labels as number one or number two. So while you're still trying to get a feel for the other side and draw a bead on what type they are, labels will always be your highest percentage shot at the very beginning when you're proceeding. And then if you find out that they resonate really well with labels, you just simply stick to them. It's your safest bet, and the way you go from being barely good enough to get by to being a superstar is just by increasing your odds a little bit at a time. Labels increase your odds. Get good at them, practice them simply, practice every day, get your reps in, and they will serve you well. How much practice should you get in? An hour a day. Make an hour label hour. Label at noon. Label over lunch. Label from 7 to 8 every day, whatever time it is. Get your practice in. Make a cheat sheet of labels. Keep it by your phone. Your cheat sheet should especially include labels of negative dynamics. Fill in a blank. It seems like you hate X. It seems like you dislike X. It seems like X is a problem for you. Have those fill in a blank labels by your phone. Have them ready. They will serve you well.
Hearing yes is a bad thing to hear.
So don't say yes.
Yeah, yes in and of themselves. I would much rather say, you know, okay, I'll do it. I love to say you win. Because when you win, you're going to perform. Yes is nothing without how. I need you to perform at a top level. You perform at a higher level when you feel like you win. If you look at me and we make a deal and you say, okay, well, that's a resigned okay, and we're going to run into trouble when we go to implement, because the minute anything bad could happen by your inaction, you know, there's a phrase, never be mean to someone who could hurt you by doing nothing, which nearly everybody can hurt you by doing nothing.
Right. So saying, okay, I'll do it.
Right.
Or yes, you win. Or you win.
Right. Right. So I want you to feel like you won.
You win.
So
you got the better end of the deal.
Yeah. Because are you going to hold to the deal if you got the best end of the deal?
Right, of course.
You love it. You can brag about
it. Awesome. Yeah. I got the better end. Huh.
Right.
So you win. Okay, I'll do it. You win. You can do both of them together.
If I say it, that's good because you won. If you say it, it's bad to me because you feel beat. I don't want you to feel beaten.
Right.
Which is one of the real big problems with negotiation, because since I've been helping people get better at it, like I get more stories. A guy says, let me tell you about this deal. I had them over a barrel. There was nowhere for them to go. You know, for all intents and purposes, I took them hostage. Well, I guarantee you that the person they beat was as passive aggressive as possible on the implementation of that deal.
They didn't feel good about it.
Money on the table.
They didn't feel good about it.
Right.
Huh.
Right.
So always make the other person feel like they got the better end of the deal. Right?
Right.
They won.
And yeah, they won.
And
it was their idea.
It was their idea. I like your idea. I'll do it. Something like that.
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's really good. And so that's why the one word answers of yes and no, those are also frequently misunderstood. You know, there's three kinds of yeses. There's commitment, confirmation, and counterfeit. Huh. And most people are used to getting lured into a trap with yes. You know, would you like to make more money? Isn't it true this is the off season? You know, whatever setup yes there is.
Would you like, okay, yeah.
You know what's leading someplace.
Yes.
One of my students is on a honeymoon, and he's wanting to get an upgrade on his bungalow, and it's the off season in this resort. Now, what they typically do is they cut prices on their basic rooms,
but they not don't the honeymoon cut, suites.
But not the honeymoon right. suites. But he knows they're all vacant. Now, what he doesn't want to cut price on a regular room. He wants a honeymoon suite, and he starts out the conversation with like, you know, isn't it true this is the off season? The general manager knows there's a trap there.
What's he say?
And so the guy starts going sideways on him immediately.
Oh, really? He didn't say yes.
Right. He didn't want to say yes because he knows that yes is commitment and yes is probably a trap. And he knows, I don't know where you're going with this, but you're going someplace.
That's what he said?
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, my student realized that, you know, he fell into this yes trap thing.
Mm.
So he had to kind of get back out of it. And they started talking, and instead of trying to get yeses and nos out of him, he started describing the situation. It started showing him a little bit. Yeah, well, I'm sure, you know, a lot of guys like me come in, we want a room, we don't want to pay anything for it. You know, you get so many tourists that are in here in the off-season, and they're cheap. That's why they're here in the off-season anyway, because they're cheap to start with, and they don't want to pay anything for anything anyway. And now the managers appreciate where the guy's coming from.
So leading with the negative.
Right. He ends up getting the upgrade.
Really?
Yeah.
Free, because he built a relationship and...
Yeah, the guy's got an empty room.
Yeah.
Never be mean to somebody who could hurt you by doing nothing. Not giving you the empty room is doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want this guy to give you a favor, and he doesn't own the hotel, and those rooms are normally vacant anyway, so his owner, whoever owns the hotel... They're not mad at him because those rooms are empty. They expected him to be empty.
Yeah.
So he's got options. You know, ultimately, you want to make the pitch like, you know, you give me that upgrade, I'm going to be a fan for life. I'm going to tell everybody how well I was treated.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell all my friends about this.
Something I've done for like the last 10 years, a friend of mine told me this line that he's like, you know, if you ever want an upgrade, if you ever want like something better in the deal, use this line. And I swear I've been using it. Maybe it's been wrong, but I'd love your opinion.
All right.
I say, what's the chance you can help me with this?
All right, so that's a what question to start
with. What's the chance?
Two things about that yeah. I like. First of all, it's a what question.
Yeah.
And secondly...
what's the chance you can upgrade me?
You're elevating the person when you're asking for help.
So you're giving them power, right?
Right.
The opportunity to have power.
Right. Yeah, so there's... And I don't know that I'd change that sentence at all. I might say in advance, like, look, this is really going to seem greedy of me.
Mm.
You know, because so you can't
leading with the negative.
Leading with the negative.
Wow.
If you try to call out a negative that's not there, you won't plant it. If you try to deny a negative that's not there, you plant that baby. And that's why you have to know the difference between a denial and a straight observation. And that's a subtle difference, because you're probably going to want to say before you ask a guy for a discount. You're probably going to say, this guy's going to think I'm cheap and I'm greedy. I don't want him to think that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you mention it all, you get instinct to say, look, like, I don't want you to think I'm cheap and greedy here. That's a denial. That plants it.
So I bet you might think that I'm being a little greedy.
I'm sure it's coming across that I'm being greedy,
but what's the chance you can upgrade me?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can support me in getting upgraded.
And so if asking for an upgrade as a human being, the guy's going, no, that's not greedy. You want them thinking no. You want them saying no.
Mm.
No is a great answer, because when somebody says no, they have just protected and defended themselves. Like, it's ridiculous. The most ridiculous question that they would never say yes to. Like if at the end of a negotiation, One of my last things I'm always going to say is, like, if you can't budge at all, I'll say, all right, well, look, it seems like you're powerless here.
Oh.
Because nobody hurts. Wants to say yes to that.
Wow.
Seems like there's nothing you could do. It seems like you're completely powerless here. And they'll put you on hold. They'll find a way to help.
So it seems like you're powerless. You can't help me. It sounds like you're powerless here.
Right. Nobody ever wants to say yes to that.
Wow. Yeah. That is powerful.
Yeah.
Do you use that a lot when you're
at the end of
the
any
phone
deal,
bill or anything or something? You
at
know?
The end of any deal, if we haven't come to an agreement that I'm happy with, that'll be the last thing. I'll say, it seems like there's nothing I could say. And it seems like you're powerless.
Seems like nothing that you could say to them to get what you need.
Right.
Or for them to move the deal points. And it seems like you're powerless.
Right.
They're powerless.
Right.
Holy cow. That's powerful insight.
So, yeah, we a lot of people have cut deals by they thought it was completely in the tank. And they're actually just trying to end positively. It's critical to end positively.
Hostage negotiation. I've read the book. For those people that don't or that haven't read the book, you've been in some crazy situations that led you to really have to understand how people think and how, like, the processes that goes through people's minds. And so you're there, like, what are some of the big takeaways that you learned in the FBI or things that, like, you don't think you would have learned elsewhere that you think the FBI does really well when it comes to understanding people?
Well, you know, the great thing about being a hostage negotiator is you start out assuming that some of the crutches that most people want are never going to be there. Like, there's a crutch that for us to make a great deal together that we have to have common ground. That's a crutch. It's a handicap. There's a crutch that I have to have alternatives. You know, my Harvard brothers and sisters advocate this thing called BATNA, best alternative to negotiated agreement. You know, and if you don't have a BATNA, you're screwed. That's a crutch. So it's really cool to start out negotiation learning from the beginning, like, I don't have to have common ground with this person. I don't have to have alternatives. I could still make a great deal. And that's what the advantage of starting out from here to begin with is. And I don't care if I have alternatives. I don't care if I have no alternatives. I'm not going to be taken hostage by that. And I think those are the great things about starting out a negotiation where I started out from. And now, you know, we're taking this into business. When I started out, there was no such thing as emotional intelligence as a phrase. I mean, if you're aware in sales and business, in any aspect of the life in general today, you know that you need emotional intelligence. Well, hostage negotiation is just emotional intelligence. So we really started out in a master class on emotional intelligence and how to make a great deal with whoever you come across. I mean, I think that's what the FBI really gets right.
So I do want to get into sales, but I know my audience is going to want at least one story from the FBI days. So take us back to, and I'll let you choose, either your first one or your most exciting one that you were actually the lead negotiator on. What did that look like? And how, like, nerve-wracking was that for you as you're sitting there? Because you've negotiated in some pretty high-profile situations, right?
Yeah. And, you know, what I love about most of the negotiations, you haven't heard of this, most of the stuff I did, because we were successful. You know, there's a phrase in the media, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, we get people out okay, and you're not going to hear about it because everybody went home, everybody lived. And so, yeah, we had some high-profile cases. I mean, I worked on a case one time with a Fox journalist.
Really?
Very few people know about this guy, Steve Santani. He gets grabbed in a Gaza Strip. The reason you don't know about it is because we got Steve Santani out of that. And he went through a horrific situation. And we did it with some really interesting approaches that the bad guys never knew we were there. The most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. We negotiated through people where they had no idea we were influencing them. Those are great negotiations where your negotiation is invisible. So, yeah, a lot of stuff that I did you haven't heard of because we did it well.
So going into the sales part or side of things and coming out of the FBI, what like, I know you talked about emotional intelligence and you say that like the FBI taught you a lot about that, but like specifically when it comes to like the pressure of sales, cause a lot of the audience that listens to this type of podcast and that, you know, is in the Facebook group and on YouTube and whatnot, they're like, hey, I get nervous, right? Or, you know, a big deal comes in, you know, I start to sweat, I get anxious or whatnot. Did the FBI teach you things specifically on helping you keep your calm and keep your nerves down? Or how did you go about figuring that out as we transition over to the sales side of things? Maybe not so much when, you know, people's lives are at stake or high profile cases, but in this setting of just, I don't know, intense situations, be that sales, be that negotiations of any sort, how important is and how did you learn that?
All right, so couple things that I think will be really helpful. You fall to your highest level of preparation. You don't rise to the occasion. You fall to your highest level of preparation. You perform as you've rehearsed. And when you're satisfied with the process, then you just let the process work its way out. You don't get rattled along the way. I've heard an analogy being, you know, a guy's walking a tightrope, guy or gal. They don't look at where they're going. They look down at their feet and they worry about the next step. You know, make the next step properly. Don't get rattled about where we're going. Let go of where you're going and focus on a process. And then in the FBI, I always learned we had the best chance of success, which means we fail sometimes. Because there's no guarantee of success. I just want the best chance of success. So get in your head, you like your process, you got the best chance of success, you do as well as you can, the universe is going to let you succeed as well as you possibly can. And then you get your practice in, you get your reps in, and understand that there's no one move that ruins everything. It's always an accumulation. So if you got a bad feeling, you're headed down the wrong path, there's a pretty good chance you need an adjustment. Maybe just a 2-millimeter shift. Maybe a tiny little shift. I mean, I love that phrase from Tony Robbins. And most of us that are Tony Robbins fans use a phrase, let's make a 2-millimeter shift. You know, I would attribute that to him. So many people I know talk about that. So make a minor adjustment and then give yourself the best chance of success. And that's where you go. And I probably rambled a little bit, answered maybe one of your three questions.
No, that's really, really good. And I like that a lot, especially with the 2-millimeter part. I actually just wrote a playbook. It's about, I don't know, 65, 67 pages long or so about habits and about the mind and about you know, subconscious and whatnot. And I talk about that specifically in there, not the 2 millimeters, but I say that like when you're going to change your life, when you're going to go try to rewire your identity, your brain, like you don't start out by trying to go and change every single area of your life. You certainly don't go try to go to your biggest habit and try to eliminate it just like that. You start at root cause and you adjust it just a little bit. And those, I don't know, who is it? Peter, what's his name? Peter Senge, I think is his name. The American systems guy was like, hey, you know, the smallest changes yield the biggest results, but the areas of biggest leverage are often, you know, the hardest to find. And I think that's super important to recognize and understand.
Never be mean to someone who could hurt you by doing nothing. That probably includes just about everybody. So be nice to everybody today. See how far that'll get you. Have an awesome day. The most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. I met the guy who started the website Post Secrets, and it was about sending in your secrets anonymously. He got a message, including a brand new Starbucks coffee cup, which proved that the guy worked at Starbucks. And the note said, I give decaf to people who are mean to me. The most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. For those of you that think you might be developing a tolerance for caffeine, well, be nice to people today. Be likable. You're 6 times more likely to make a deal with somebody you like. Be likable. It increases your deal-making ability. Plus, when you're likable, you're in a better frame of mind, you're more positive, you're 31% smarter. So be likable, you increase your deal-making ability, you make yourself smarter, and you have a better day.
The last impression is the lasting impression. What's more important than the first impression? The last impression. You can get away with a mediocre first impression. You can't get away with a mediocre last impression. Make a positive impression at the end. Say something that's true. Express positive regard. Express positive hope for a great outcome. Whatever it has to be. The last impression is the lasting impression. It seeds the next conversations, and it's what leaves the lasting impression. Make it a good one.
All right, guys. Chris Voss here, author of Never Split the Difference, CEO of the Black Swan Group. A team of negotiators that really will help you get better at negotiation. Today, what I want to talk to you about is negotiating smarter, not harder. How do we negotiate smarter, not harder? Well, the first thing is to think about how we treat the word maybe and things that sound like maybe. I'm kind of shocked. Maybe not shocked. How many people use maybe or something that masquerades or maybe in the negotiations? We just exercise on a regular basis that we do with our clients when we're training them. We call it 60 seconds or she dies. You get a role play, a hostage negotiation where I am the bank robber. And I get you started. I say, I need a car in 60 seconds or she dies. Only problem is the first rule of the negotiation is I've already told you that you can't give me transportation. And the first thing I do is I turn around and ask you for a car. You know, I've been surprised at the number of people that we train that give me some version of maybe. Maybe I could do that. Maybe I could get your car if I just had more time. This overall theme of how to negotiate without bargaining. And again, it gets back to how do you negotiate smarter, not harder. Well, treat every maybe like it's a no, or anything that sounds like a maybe. Treat it like it's a no. Don't sucker for the hope side of it. Maybe I could get this, or I'll try, whatever that might sound like in one way, shape, or form. Treat your maybes like a no. I had a businessman a number of years ago tell me as soon as he started treating all his maybes as a no, his business really moved forward. How do I want you to do this? Label it. Come back with a label. You could even say, you know, that sounds like a maybe to me. Or you might say, it sounds like there's problems here. Focus on the no aspect of this, the stuff that sounds like non-starters. Identify them, get them out of the way. Use labels to do that, and you'd be surprised at how much more effective your negotiations are and how far fewer times you get caught up in a quicksand of maybe. Negotiate smarter, not harder. I wish you the best.
Hi, Nicole. How are you? Hi, Chris. I didn't have a question. I was just back channeling with Ronan, and I'm a voice actor, and I absolutely adore you, Chris. I think you have probably helped so many more people than you even know. And I love what you have to say about tones of voice and mirroring and the playful kind of accommodator voice and the analyst and the late night DJ. That really works. It worked earlier. I heard you. So that's just my two cents. If you ever want to practice anything or just, you know, show people what that might sound like, I'm here for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris, you know the FM radio DJ voice excites this audience. If you want to give it to them at any point, I mean, I'm not going to stop you.
Well, I would never want to blatantly do that.
Oh my god. How does it work, and when would you use it? I can ask that question.
You know, all right, how it works is it actually triggers a neurochemical response in your brain. It has a calming influence on people, a slowing down influence. You know, they taught us that. I learned it on the suicide hotline, and then as a hostage negotiator. The mechanisms specifically are still in dispute because so much of the brain, exactly how the brain works. Like, for example, I used to say it was mirror neurons. I was triggering your mirror neurons, and it was causing an involuntary response, sort of the way the doctor, you know, hits your knee with a little hammer and there's a neurological response. And, I mentioned Andrew Huberman. I love listening to Andrew's podcasts. And I'm listening to him the other day, and he's going, I got news for all you people out there. There's no such thing as mirror neurons. Neuroscience is there's no mirror neurons. But then he says, but there is emotional resonance circuitry, and we don't know exactly what it is, but we know it works. And I'm like, all right, so the effect is the same. You just can't tell me what, you know, how it works. But I know that, you know, your emotional resonance circuitry, I can make you feel calm. I can make you feel my confidence. Calm is contagious. Also, if I smile, then I can trigger you to smile too. And that's going to have a different emotional effect on you. And then if I could put the two of them together, you know, you can have some great conversations and have great interactions. I'm not threatening. I'm on your side. And it does me no, it does, it might do me good short term to threaten you, but it never does me good long term. So this is about long term relationships.
In your negotiating days, was there an instance where it really didn't go the way you wanted it to go?
Yeah. And with 93% success rate means 7% of the time it's going bad. And that's just the nature of the game.
Is there one that stands out for you as being?
Well, every one of them does. But then the issue is, do you learn? Like Nassim Nicholas Taleb would call it post-traumatic stress growth. Like you go through a traumatic event. Are you traumatized by it, which and then damaged and never recover? Post-traumatic stress injury, harm, disorder, or is there post-traumatic stress growth where you took that and decided to be better than you ever were before because you never want to let that happen again?
When I say this, what is the incident that comes to mind?
Well, the first one that people died in was the second case that I worked in the Philippines, the Burnham Sabero case. And early on, before we could even get our arms around like a situation that was moving really fast, and the Philippine military was engaged in chasing the bad guys, and a chase had been on for weeks. Guillermo Sabero was murdered by the Abu Sayyaf about 21 days into that case. They had already killed a number of Filipinos prior to that. And as they moved across the landscape and the oceanscape and island to island south of the Philippines, they would kill hostages and pick up new hostages because there were people in their way all the time. So that was an ugly case from the beginning to the end. In the end of it, the two of the three remaining hostages were killed in a botched rescue attempt, and they were shot by friendly fire. Mm-hmm. Philippine Scout Rangers inadvertently stumbled over the Abu Sayyaf encampment, didn't realize it was one that had hostages in it, just opened fire. They recognized it as a terrorist encampment, formed a skirmish line on the trees on the uphill side, and just started pouring rifle fire down into the camp. And so that was the first time that I'd worked anything where people had gotten killed.
Does that stay with you?
Yeah, it does. It does. And I felt sorry for myself for a long time. And it's not like I'm happy about it, but I'll never remember the moment that I got the call 5:30 in the morning. I was in Washington, D.C., where I lived, and a voice on the other end of the phone said, I've got bad news. Martin is dead. And it was just a few hours after Martin Burnham had been killed and Deborah Yap, the Filipino hostage, had been killed. Martin's wife, Gracia, was wounded and lived. And I'll never forget, that was the worst, that to that point and since, was the worst personal moment of my professional career. And I used to say it's the worst moment of my personal career until I was hearing another hostage negotiator talking about a siege he was in when an infant had died, had been killed. And I remember sitting there watching him talk about it, and he's still very definitely dealing with the scars and the wounds from having been the negotiator on scene. And I remember him saying, like, you know, I don't know why I keep telling, you know, giving these presentations. Maybe I just want people to know something bad that happened to me on a winter's day. And I was sitting there thinking, bad for you. that wasn't your blood. It wasn't your child. And I thought, you know, we're taking on too much because it wasn't a member of our family. It wasn't my brother. It wasn't my significant other. It wasn't my son that got killed. And that's when I tried to, that's when I realized I had to put that stuff in perspective. It wasn't doing anybody any good for me feeling sorry for myself. I couldn't. And what we, the changes we made as a result of the Burnham Sbarro case saved lives. You know, that was our mandate. All right, so Martin Burnham is dead. What do we do with that? Do we quit or do we get better? If we get better, somebody else is going to live. And a whole bunch of people ended up living based on strategy adjustments we made as a result of that case.
Seems like a very significant sort of burden to carry, right? It goes back to what I said at the start. You know, it takes a certain type of person to want to play with those stakes.
Yeah, somebody who's naive.
Yeah.
You just don't know any better.
Makes us difficult sometimes, just thinking about the, you know, the traumatic things we go through. It makes us much difficult, especially in forming relationships. I struggled with that a lot. Struggled in having a girlfriend, probably because my home life was so traumatic that I would always run from commitment. But when you've lived in such through, and you hear the same with like soldiers and stuff, you know, when you've lived through such sort of traumatic events and high stakes, coming home to, hey babe, you're right, can be difficult, right?
Yeah, it can be. It can be difficult. Like you can have difficulty unwinding. The other person, depending upon how you process information, like the other person might genuinely doing their best to be there with you to get you to talk about it. Mm. And, you know, if that isn't the best way that you process it, and yeah, one of the very difficult things about me is I don't process stuff by talking about it. I'll talk about it afterwards, you know, but I kind of need to unplug. You know, I'll need a good night's sleep. You know, I'll need to let it run through the data banks and kind of bake on its own. I'm probably pretty good the next day.
Which is interesting because in your work, you have no time for that.
Yeah, well, you know, and maybe that's why I need it more at home, because in the work, I mean, we're going to, you know, we're going on it right now. We're dealing with it right now.
Mirroring, something you talk about as well in the book, which I find really interesting, because again, something with my girlfriend I started to explore, which was, you know, when she says something to me or when she does something, I, to make her again feel heard, I guess I just kind of repeat it back to her,
right?
But also trying to, is it also a body language thing, or is it just how does mirroring work?
Well, the hostage negotiators mirror, the black swans mirror, you know, the way that we teach in business now is just all verbal.
Okay.
You know, if you start lining up physically, which is what the body language mirroring thing is, like if that happens naturally, then so be it. Enough people try to do it as a manipulative tool that we're really leery of even coaching people on that at all. Like if we're talking and suddenly we both find us, and I'm actually listening and you're listening, and we both find ourselves leaning the same direction, that's cool because we're dialed in. But the body language thing is a tool of manipulation so many times of people that are just trying to exploit you. That aspect of it, we stay away from. Now, the hostage negotiator mirror, the black swan mirror, repeating just the last 1 to 3 words of what somebody said, or then taken surgically, picking a gist, 1 to 3 words here and there, is ridiculously effective.
Ridiculously effective?
Yeah.
I did that.
You did. Very nice. And the thing that I find fascinating about it, too, is, like, if we find somebody that's really into mirroring, they'll typically be somebody whose IQ and EQ both are real high. And there are a lot of people whose IQ is real high. You know, their book smarts are good, but their people smarts aren't good. And they tend to love mirroring because it's the least amount of effort with the maximum amount of response. And they want to guide a negotiation in a very gentle but purposeful way. While the other side doesn't feel guided, they feel like they're expanding. And it's been real consistent.
Wow. There's so many.
You know, and well, it was really in a previous case that I was talking about where things went bad, because our mistake was, and I didn't even know this is what happens to a lot of salespeople, and I heard a salesperson talk about it as being single-threaded. Like, I'm at a sales conference a couple of years ago, and this woman's talking about, you know, she had a great relationship with the person on the other side, and she thought the deal was going down, and they got a signed agreement, and then he took his agreement back to his company, and they said, no, we're not doing this. And since you separated yourself from us and agreeing to this, her counterpart, not only did she not get the deal, but they got fired. The guy, her counterpart got fired.
Who are the most difficult people to work with then? Would you say it's the alpha people, or would you say it's the uncertain people, or what type of people are hard to work in negotiation with?
You know, you're talking about a little bit of a tight match, and that has a tendency, it's a little bit based on how bad I want to make the deal. Like, I don't like liars. Hmm. Or I don't like, the most difficult people to work with in the long run are people who haven't thought anything through, which is as bad as a liar, only their heart's not in the wrong place.
They don't know what they want specifically.
Right. Or they don't know how they're going to get this done, which is, again, we go over and over again. I go over and over again. Yes is nothing without how. Like, and the person who thinks like yes is going to make a deal. Well, yes is not going to make a deal because you got to have how. Mm. How are we going to put this together? And someone that doesn't think things through a lot of times, they're actually kind of dysfunctional on their own side. So they'll make promises they can't keep, and they have no idea they can't keep those promises.
Right.
And so when they take your deal, you think you've done a deal with them, they take it back to their company, and their company goes like, no, we're not doing this. This is a stupid idea. We can't do this.
Sure.
And that happens a lot. I think in a private sector, I've heard from a number of companies that fully 50% of the deals that they make that don't go through get killed internally. Because somebody cut a deal for them and they took it back to the company. And the company says, no, that violates our terms and conditions.
Right.
We can't deliver on that basis. So you're dealing with someone who just has no, doesn't have a clue as to what's going on their side.
Sure.
There are a lot of people like that.
When you're making a business deal, what do you recommend as the amount of time to consider the deal before saying, yes, let's do it? Like, here's the deal points. Here's what you want. Here's what I want. Okay, should we sign it right away? Should we give it 24 hours? Should we take it to our team? Should it be a week? You know, what's like kind of a standard, you think?
Unless you've got something in line ahead of time. The company name is the Black Swan Group because we believe there's black swans in every negotiation, which is something you didn't know that as soon as you found out, it's going to change all the parameters.
The deal. Gotcha.
So you sit down at the table to find out the unknowns.
Huh.
And it's impossible to research all the unknowns. Plus, a lot of the unknowns, I'll find them a lot faster if I just ask you.
Right.
And I could research for 2 weeks something that I may be able to get you to tell me about in 10 minutes.
For example, what do you mean, something you'd want to ask?
I'm speaking to a long-time client, and they have another firm that I've been affiliated with coming doing a different block. When I found out they were doing that block, I could subtly reach back through my network to find out what the competing / partnership firm of mine is, what they're charging, or I could just flat out
ask them.
Well, I need to get the information. A lot of information you got to get by not asking. You got to trigger it. The phrase, ask good questions, it's really get good information. And a lot of times you won't tell me stuff if I ask. But if I act like I already know, or if there are other ways, hostage negotiators trigger information without asking questions. And hostage negotiators get that information and make you feel good about giving it at the same time.
Getting back to the question of the through line, what is it that you've noticed through your life that grabbed your attention and landed you in what you're doing?
Yeah, great question. You really got me thinking, and maybe two different things. I mean, the first one is, you know, I like figuring stuff out. My father had a very figured out attitude, his approach to life, and then growing up under my father's roof. I mean, he expected his kids to work and to figure things out. So I think it was, and I had no choice. Like, you know, my older sister and I, my dad wanted a new garage. He handed us, we had an old garage in the backyard. He handed us crowbars and said, go figure out how to tear the old garage down. I think it was about 11 or 12 years old at the time. So,
what was
but I've always enjoyed figuring things out. And I think that's the biggest piece.
Did you go through a phase because, you know, I'm now seeing my grandchildren and, you know, kids can be a little bit ornery. Did you go through a phase where he said, figure it out, where you, you know, push back a little bit, but then as soon as you got into it, you got the self-satisfaction. Hey, it's pretty neat figuring stuff out. You feel pretty independent. Was there a rebellious streak in you at all?
Yeah, you know, and everybody has one at some point in time, and it manifests itself in different ways. I was never openly rebellious. There was a period of time when I was about 18 years old that I literally, my father never struck me the way, you know, a man would strike another man. He spanked me when I was little, not a whole bunch of times. But, you know, when I got to be more his size, he never struck me. And I made him angry enough for good reason when I was 18 that I was sure that he was going to pummel me. But
What happened?
You know, I just became the summer between my senior year in high school and my freshman year in college, I became just useless, just completely apathetic. You know, he sent me out on tasks and I would do a horrible job. You know, I was utterly useless. And he at some point in time, you know, he's paying me. You know, he's not paying me to be useless. I remember he had enough. And he had, you know, in his business where his office was in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, I remember him taking me in the alley behind the office and beginning to completely lose his cool at me. And I was certain that, you know, and I knew my father was very good with his hands. I never saw firsthand, but I knew stories of him brawling when he was in the Marines. I was certain he was going to pummel me, and he did not, but he did get my attention.
Do you think you didn't, you respected him, didn't you?
Yes.
And do you think that part of, I'm a shrink, I dissect some of these things. Do you think that part of it was thinking, geez,
not— Are you charging me for this session? Am I going to have to pay for this? No, but, I'm on a couch right now, right?
But I'm seeing a situation, he takes you back there, he's about to lose it. He's really pissed off at you. But if I'm Chris at 18, I'm thinking, geez, I really disappointed this guy that I respect.
Yeah, well, there's a fair amount of cognitive thought there that sometimes 18-year-olds in the midst of all their hormone changes and growth can't really connect the dots at the time. I'm not sure that I was bright enough at the time for that to occur to me. It did get my attention.
Yeah.
I straightened up right away. I remember the very next day, he found out that I did something right. He drove 30 miles to congratulate me.
Wow.
And, you know, then I think I slowly straightened out my act. I mean, later that fall, I actually went out of my way to help him out on something that I knew he was having a real problem with, and I knew he appreciated that. So I think it sunk into my subconscious, if not my conscious, that I disappointed a man that I respected and I needed to straighten up.
Yeah. I've been blessed. I've had 8 mentors. They've all died. The last one was Larry King and a guy named Warren Bennis before him. And
an impressive list.
Yeah, I was very fortunate, and but they, I'll tell you, not disappointing them was the top of my list. I would never tell them I was ever going to do something unless I was 150% sure I was going to do it, and because their esteem for me was amazing, you know when you get someone to think that, hey, you know, you might be kind of special in this way. There was nothing as good as that. And my father, my brothers and I, we had sort of a troubled relationship. So I think that's one of the reasons I sought out mentors and things like that. But get us back to you. You're the guest there. So you straighten out your life and then take us from there. And what came to be important to you as you started to straighten out and get on with your life?
Well, you know, I think, you know, doing the right thing. that sounds like a cliche, but it's always been something that resonated with me. And, you know, despite all the stupid stuff that I did, you know, through my late teens, early mid 20s, like really stupid stuff. And we never stopped doing stupid stuff, of course, but
can you just serve up one of those? Because see, one of the challenges my audience has is, God, you have guests and they're just perfect. I mean, I can't do what they do because they're just perfect. I'm just some guy listening in or some woman listening in. And so the more that people can humanize themselves with a little bit of a humor. So can you share one of the, and I'll match you stupid and foolish for stupid and foolish. Trust me.
Yeah. You know, and that's a great point to bring up too, because that myth needs to be pierced. I mean, Ferris's book, Tools of the Titans, I think that I was looking at several years ago. One of my big takeaway early on was he said, like, all successful people have deep flaws. Like, there ain't nothing out there. Is no such thing as an unflawed human being. Probably no such thing as someone who's not deeply flawed. And all of your heroes and all of your idols are the same. They got real serious flaws. And so, yeah, that's, you know, just, yeah, growing up in Iowa, I grew up as fairly goody two shoes. Like, the worst thing I ever did was drink beer illegally in a cornfield, or drinking age in Iowa when I was growing up was 18, and I turned 18 when I was still in high school with it. You know, I mean, even drinking and driving at all. I never got arrested for drunk driving, only by the grace of God. And which is why when a judge, and somebody is arrested for drunk driving, the judge realized that ain't the first time this person was drunk driving. You know, thank God for Uber and Lyft, because they're no excuse for getting behind a wheel with any alcohol in your system now. And which is a rule that I pretty much stick to. I can't remember. I don't think I'm breaking that anymore. But I did, you know, and I was lucky enough that I never got arrested for it. And I never got into an accident when I was drinking. Grace of God only. And mostly stuff along those lines, because I was, you know, in Iowa, in the environment that I grew up in, like, the worst thing, I didn't smoke marijuana when I left high school. I wouldn't even talk to people that smoked marijuana. And I got to college and there were people that I thought were really cool, and I'd be in a gathering and somebody would break out a joint and I'd be like, what? I thought you were cool. How dare you drink this or smoke this illegal substance? And then I can remember, then I didn't know how to refuse it. I was afraid to be around people that were refusing it. And I'm sitting around in my fraternity one night on the roof, bunch of guys drinking, and then they started passing around a joint, and they went to hand it to another guy in the fraternity that I really held a lot of esteem for. And he just went, no, thanks. And nothing bad happened to him. And I thought, wow, if it's that easy just to say, just to refuse if you don't want it. Not succumb to peer pressure. So, but you know, I struggled with my life like everybody else did.
So you just happened upon that example where you said, gee, that's pretty simple. Just say no thanks. Because if you're not familiar with Chris's work or Never Split the Difference, he comes up with these responses to almost any situation that are what I call hidden in plain sight brilliant. I never would have thought of that, and I think that would work. So can you share a little bit how that evolved? Because you are a master. I've watched you. People could hit you up with any question, and you seem to have a counterintuitive, I never would have thought of that kind of response. It's almost like you're almost an artist in the way that you do that.
That's very kind. I think my first approach is, first of all, you know, I don't care what works. I just want to know what works. And you were talking about Larry King being curious, you know, when you and I were talking earlier before, and curiosity is a superpower. And like, I just want to know what works. If I got to figure it out, like, you know, what works? And, you know, nobody figures stuff out without somebody spurring the thought in their head. Like, they either see it done, or in many cases, when we're teaching a Black Swan method, we won't give you the answer to a question until we burn the question in your brain. And we got an extremely intense negotiation exercise we put people through, extremely intense, called 60 Seconds So She Dies. We don't tell you how to deal with it until we, you know, until you feel like you've theoretically been beaten with a baseball bat, having gone through it. Then afterwards, we start laying out how to handle a high pressure, high intensity negotiation. And sometimes people say, well, what, you know, why the heck didn't you teach me that before you put me through the exercise? Well, you wouldn't have hung on to it until you understood that you had a problem that you needed solving. And so I think probably that smoking marijuana instance back, you know, when it was a horrible thing to do, you could go to jail for serious time for even being in possession of marijuana back in those days. Right or wrong, I ain't saying it's right or wrong, it's the way it was. Like, I didn't know how to refuse just and not be ridiculed or embarrassed. I mean, I'm up in my head, my amygdala, which I know you're well familiar with what that amygdala does to you. You know, my amygdala is whispering in my ear, just like it does everybody else's. And then I see this guy just go, no thanks. And everybody was cool. And I needed to see somebody do it. I knew I'd been struggling with it. Somebody did it. I was like, wow, that's all there is to that? Wow, okay. You know, it didn't look that hard.
So can you share a few nuggets to whet people's appetites, that some of the things that you've observed, you've learned, you've taught, that when people hear it, they'd say, that's not so hard, and that would work, you know. So to build on what you just said, I focus on what works. You know, I'm not trying to be some super intellectual academic type. I look at a situation, it's got a problem, what's going to work to fix it? So can you share a few examples that when people discover them, they just smile in disbelief, like, oh my God, it's so simple.
Well, yeah, the opening story of Never Split the Difference revolves around the phrase, how am I supposed to do that? And when somebody has given you a challenge that either is ridiculously difficult for you or you just can't do, like, how do you not refuse, but how do you begin to telegraph to them that this is going to be a problem? Or how do you get them to maybe change your perspective? Like, and the response is not, I can't do that. The first response is, how am I supposed to do that? And that is like transformatively effective for people negotiating with difficult situations. Now, the downside of it is like 8 out of 10 times you get a 180 degree turn in the situation. Now, one in 10, you know, I would say 2 in 10 to be generous, but 1 in 10 maybe. It doesn't work, which you get, and people that are so used to that being a home run will get back to us and say, how am I supposed to do that fail? And we say, no, it didn't fail. It just gave you a different picture of what's going on. The 1 in 10 times that somebody turns right back on you and says, that's your problem. I don't care what happens to you. That's your problem. People are so flummoxed by that, they said, this failed. Well, it didn't fail. What happened was you got feedback that was different than what you expected. With that feedback, the person just blatantly told you they do not care about you in any way, shape, or form, which now you got a second decision to make. Do I want to continue? Is this a business partner? Is this a colleague? Is this a kidnapper? Is this a proverbial terrorist? But you now know what you're dealing with. And in our business and our personal life, the real answer there is move on. As hard as it is, this is a, you know, who wants to stay in a business or personal relationship with somebody that doesn't care about you? But how am I supposed to do that? I learned that question from a Pittsburgh drug dealer.
Well, share that story a little bit quickly.
Well, we had a kidnapping in the Philippines that had gone really bad right after a really successful one. The very next one was a train wreck. The Burnham Sabero case. 2 out of 3 of the Americans ended up dead. A bunch of Filipinos ended up dead. And in the midst of it, I knew that someone had acquired proof of life by getting one of our hostages on the phone. And to me, that was magic. Like, we'd love to get proof of life, but we never got a hostage on the phone. So what the heck is going on if somebody else got a hostage on the phone Not only that, who's doing that? There are multiple buyers for the same hostage. This is supposed to be a buyer's market. That's supposed to be a bidding war. And it flummoxed me. Never got the answer in the case. And then there's a drug dealer and drug dealer kidnapping in Pittsburgh. A few months later, one drug dealer grabs another drug dealer's girlfriend. Now, in the United States, when somebody in your family gets kidnapped, no matter what your occupation is, you're probably going to the FBI. So this drug dealer went to the FBI in Pittsburgh. You know, help. So FBI hostage negotiators are riding around in the victim drug dealer's car, taping the conversations with the bad guy drug dealer, which I realize is a redundant term. But out of the blue, the victim drug dealer just asks a fair, natural question. And he says, I'll never forget the words, "Hey, dog, how do I know she's all right?" The how question. And there's this long silence on the other end of the line. And a drug dealer says, "I'll put her on the phone." And that's when I went like, wow. It took, you know, somebody like this, this was eating at me. I didn't know the answer. And somebody in a very practical situation who was not a sophisticated FBI hostage negotiator just asked the natural and normal question that the other side has got to allow you to ask. They may not like, you may not like the way that you answer it, but this is a legit question. We started using various forms of how with every bad guy that you can imagine on Earth. And it never made things worse, and 9 out of 10 times it made things exponentially better. You know, at worst, they always said, that's your problem. That's actually not an escalation. And it's, since it's more information, you're better off, but it never made things worse.